Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Matthew Witt. Matt is University of La Verne, California, Associate Professor of Public Administration. Matt has been on the program a number of times before. We've had some very, very invigorating, rigorous, instructive discussions, and I'm sure we're going to have another one today. Matt, I welcome you to the program again. You're lucky to be out west. You're avoiding the brutal weather that is hitting the Northeast today, and we've had some tougher weather coming to Chicago. We didn't get too much snow downtown, but we have what's called here the Siberian Express moving in.
Oh, wow.
I think it's rather self-descriptive. A couple of days of very, very tough weather. It's good days to stay in and write. Anyway, lots to discuss, Matt. I'm eager to hear your thoughts on many issues. Let me just bring up one. Maybe we can touch on this at the beginning of the program and then jump into some of the things that concern you. I mentioned yesterday and discussed briefly Lynn Stewart's release after being unjustly imprisoned for over 4 years. Lynn certainly is not a criminal, and she was literally railroaded through a kangaroo court proceedings and all kinds of stuff that went on that literally got her railroaded first for 28 months and then increased under federal appeals court pressure to 10 years. And she wasn't in good health when she went in. She developed cancer and advanced to stage 4. She's in very, very precarious shape. Well, she's out. She came out New Year's Day. She's back home, thankfully. She'll get the kind of care that she needs, and I certainly hope that she'll get it in time to recover. One other thought, one other topic. This is one I write a lot about, Matt, what's going on in the Middle East and occupied Palestine, and there is another round of so-called peace negotiations going on. I don't know how many articles I've written on past and current so-called peace talks. There simply is no such thing as a negotiated peace in Palestine. And the very idea of one really is insulting to anybody who knows what's going on. So-called talks arrive dead on arrival every single time. They began decades ago. It's hard to know exactly when they began because there were lots of on and off discussions and talks, but they go back at least maybe around 35, 40 years. If two opposing sides can't make peace over that period of time, when one side absolutely wants it and will bend over backwards to get it, short of, you know, selling out every right it has, then there's got to be something wrong with the process. Well, it's a no-peace peace process, which is one way that I describe it, and that certainly is what's going on today. And I have a new article that I will get out tomorrow. I wrote one a day or two ago, and my new one tomorrow is called Kerry's Peace Plan, Worthless. And I use the word worthless because it's how one of the Palestinian officials described it. He called it a worthless framework, quote-unquote. Yeah. Well, it's more a frame-up than a framework, and it really is disgraceful.
I like that. It's a pretense. It's a kind of show trial, I guess. It's a malapropism here, maybe. But you know, it seems to be for the benefit of a world stage that requires something, some kind of symbolic gestures that make Israel over as a, you know, a stand-up nation, or its government, as it were, as reputable. And it's, I agree completely with you, Stephen. It's a pretense. And then some.
It really is a pretense, and the notion that Israel is a democracy is absolutely absurd. Israel absolutely is no democracy. It never was. I would have to say that from establishment, Israel was no democracy. Well, how could it be when it was established through the blood and dispossession of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians? Israel wanted to get rid of them all, but it couldn't do it. There were still a good many left. And yet these people were denied virtually all rights. They're treated like fifth column threats. I mean, they're human beings. They need to be treated like human beings, but they never were. And of course, that was in 1948. Again, in late 1947, Israel's so-called War of Independence. and Israel declared its independence 15th of May, 1948. Harry Truman, moments after midnight, I think Israel time, was the first president, the first world leader to recognize Israel's independence. And I remember writing, Matt, that the future president, Israel's prime minister, is the guy who runs the country. So now it's Benjamin Netanyahu. The president is really a figurehead, but Israel also has a figurehead. Now it's Shimon Peres. He's in his 90s. He's a former prime minister. But Israel's first president was Chaim Weizmann, and David Ben-Gurion was the first prime minister. But Chaim Weizmann, the story went, made a trip to Washington to meet with Harry Truman months before the 1948 election. And anybody who remembers it the way I do, I was 14 years old, so I do remember it. I can even remember a couple of comments made by a neighbor after the election was over, when Dewey, the Republican candidate, was odds-on favorite to win, and there was a famous Chicago Tribune headline. printed before the results came out, which didn't come out as quickly back in those days, Matt, as they do today. You know, as soon as the polls close, you get the final result of who won and who lost. But it took a little longer back in 1948. But a famous, infamous Chicago headline, I lived in Boston at the time, but the Chicago Tribune headline in big, bold, black letters said, Dewey wins.
Well, there's that classic picture of Truman holding up the headline, right?
Exactly.
Right after the
I'm sure Truman took that one to his grave, absolutely loving it, loving every minute of it. Well, the polls, which weren't as accurate then as they are today, predicted Dewey would win, but he didn't. Truman won. But the deal with Weizmann was, the story, and I can't verify it, but it's possible it was true, that he came to visit Truman with a suitcase full of cash. He wanted Truman's endorsement for a new Israeli state once it was declared, once its war of independence was won, which was really a rollover, and history tells it exactly the opposite of the way it was. It was a rollover, but Israel declared its independence, and Harry Truman came through with the first recognition.
Yeah. There, are you familiar with the author Gilad Atzmon?
I'm not, Matt.
Interesting guy. He authored a few years back a book titled The Wandering Who.
Oh, I know the title.
Oh, yeah, A Story of Jewish Identity Politics. And he came to Laverne and did a chat, engaging guy, talented musician, very, very accomplished saxophonist, jazz musician, and authored this book, sort of amateur historian, or not so amateur, but he made a point in his presentation saying that, you know, Jews claiming Israel as a homeland would be something like, you know, Rome returning to Britannia and claiming, you know, we were here first.
Boy, exactly.
It was a long time ago. It's a long time ago, but we were here, a couple thousand years, and now we're back, and we're claiming right of return to one of our homelands. But I appreciated the irony of his point that what are we really talking about when we're talking about Israel?
Oh, absolutely. Israel really needed the Nazi atrocities against the Jews. And it needed World War II. It needed a lot of support from the West to do what it did. And of course, it began with the Balfour Declaration in 1917, the British, that guaranteed the Jews a homeland in the Middle East. But a lot of the Jews that came to Israel, they really would have preferred to go someplace else rather than to go to an isolated desert. I mean, what would people in Eastern Europe, where so many came from, why would they want to leave their home in Eastern Europe, especially after the war, and go to a desert?
Right.
So you really needed the atrocities to make them feel like, you know, you don't want to go through this again. So better to go to a place that's a Jewish homeland and you'll be safer than you will if you stay where you are, because, you know, there could be another Hitler and you'll go through it again.
It's you know, takes the breath away thinking about the consequences of that incident. This comes to mind, that incident, that Holocaust, comes to mind, Stephen, that you bring it up, a very interesting study by Guido Preparata, Conjuring Hitler, is the title, How Britain and America Made the Third Reich. And he does a nice job there of doing a kind of network analysis of the players and influences, and in particular in the British High Command, the British Parliament. And what he speculates was a ruse, a sort of cutout process that made for the appearance that there was ever any kind of dissent between those who were for appeasement and those who were not for appeasement. And that, in fact, Britain had been engineering the hemming in of Germany for decades, since the Franco-Prussian War, the conclusion of that, and the rise of Germany as the mighty power. And I, you know, many people know this already. It was new to me. I'm not a historian, but the thought that America and Britain were very, very close in jockeying Hitler into position, explicitly with the intention to create, you know, a isolated, increasingly isolated state in Germany, particularly after the Peace of Versailles had so hobbled and humiliated the nation and the people, was sort of remarkable to me. That Hitler didn't just come out of nowhere. No one does, but the extent to which the Anglo Axis was involved, from Preparata's study, and he's pulling from a lot of stuff that many other people know about, is really remarkable. Now, to what extent all of that was with the intention of creating the beachhead of Israel in the Middle East as a way to launder an imperial agenda for acquiring oil, we can speculate, putting the most harmed people on the planet at that time in that place would certainly be, from the standpoint of imperial interest, logically a remarkable cover story for establishing those corporate interests behind the righteous facade of the State of Israel. So there it is.
Oh, indeed, and I agree that Hitler certainly did not come out of nowhere. He was handpicked, and I think Western bankers, especially British ones, were very much involved in getting Hitler placed in power. And it took an appointment to make him chancellor. He didn't win a majority in the last election before the Nazis took power. And that he needed von Hindenburg, I think, was president then, the World War One general, an aged man. And I think he was getting well up in years and maybe a little bit senile. And he was pushed very hard to appoint Hitler chancellor, and he did. And, of course, the hammer came down very quickly after Hitler got power. And as they say, the rest is history. But pretty awful stuff. And World War One was really a battle between Germany and Britain, instigated, I think, mostly by Britain, because Germany was growing in influence and industrial might and so on. And, you know, Britain wanted to be king of the hill just the way America wants to be king of the hill today. And it was really losing the race to Germany. So I guess they thought that they needed a war to put Germany down. And an awful lot of people suffered. Maybe 25 million people died. And the slogan never again was meaningless, because it certainly happened again. And after World War II, maybe killed, who knows how many died in World War II. It probably at least doubled to 25 million, maybe a lot more than that. And Russia in both wars, I think, took the brunt of the casualties. Just terrible. And in post-World War II, we've had nonstop wars. We haven't had a so-called world war, but we've had wars after war after war, multiple wars in various parts of the world, and they just go on endlessly.
Yes. Well, that's the imperial regime.
Yes.
The imperial way. On the speaking of which, I wanted to hear your thoughts and maybe dredge up a little sort of discussion. Revelations about Snowden that are coming out. I don't know if you saw Feibel Edmonds' Boiling Frogs. She does really excellent investigative work. Right, Feibel Edmonds, formerly of the FBI, was a whistleblower, Iranian national, did high-level interpretive work for them.
Oh, indeed.
And was
I have not followed what she has said. What exactly is she saying, Matt?
Well, she's calling questions. She's bringing to attention questions that have been out there, but that are now coming to a head about the weird triangle of interests emerging around Snowden between the journalist Glenn Greenwald and the PayPal billionaire Omidyar. What is Omidyar's first name? I'll find it. But the Omidyar is backing Greenwald, and in this sort of this cause celeb around Snowden, Greenwald seems to have exclusive access to Snowden. Snowden is only talking to Greenwald. Greenwald has this PayPal billionaire with a murky past and security state connections behind him. There's exclusive business deals struck between Greenwald and Omidyar, $1 million book and movie deals being made pertaining to the leaked documents, and a very mysterious change of position in the U.S. stand in response in the midst of all the publicity around the leaked NSA cache, according to Edmonds. So on the surface, there's these questions: where's this guy Omidyar coming from? What's his interest? But there's also more questions about Snowden coming up that are getting, sort of brushed aside. Who was this guy? Margie Burns, journalist Margie Burns, in June, posed some questions. I'm not sure where. I could check that here online while we talk. But she raised questions somewhere, wondering about how Snowden had been a U.S. Army Special Forces recruit. He had been a covert CIA operative and an NSA employee in various capacities, all in just a few short years, and this guy's only 29 years old. And so she asked, how exactly did Snowden get his series of NSA jobs? Did he apply through regular channels? Was it through someone he knew who recommended him? Who were his references for a string of six-figure, high-level security jobs? Are there any safeguards in place so that red flags go up when a subcontractor jumps from job to job, especially in high-level clearance positions? And then there was more work. A few months later, Mark Ames and Yasha Levine examined the relationship between Greenwald and Omidyar. Claims that Omidyar is a philanthropist with humanitarian interest is being examined as not entirely true. So Omidyar also apparently has these murky connections, along with his PayPal colleagues. Max Levchin, his co-founder of PayPal, openly stated his support for NSA spying on Americans. Alex Karp, another affiliate, used PayPal framework to start Palantir, the most important company providing spying technology to the NSA. One of Palantir's advisors is Condoleezza Rice, also former CIA director George Tenet. Peter Thiel has some interesting right-wing connections along with Omidyar. He started his career working for the CIA-linked law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. I don't know if that's the Sullivan and Cromwell that goes back to the Dulles brothers. I suspect it is. And then Credit Suisse Group. And so these are this sort of set of odd, it would seem, connections. If Snowden is really this guy, this valiant whistleblower, how come these questions can't be answered about him? How come he hasn't answered these questions? How come now Greenwald indicates there isn't just like 50,000 pages? There's more like 2 million pages of documents. The questions then become, wait a minute, is this a limited hangout? Is this a pretense of a whistleblow to target certain groups with selective leaks laundered through the otherwise reputable cachet of a guy with himself a valiant career, Glenn Greenwald, unimpeachable credibility, being on all the right radio programs, interviewed by all the right people? What's really going on here?
Well, those are very, very interesting points that you raise, Matt. I think you really presented that awfully well. And
I'm gleaning from the work of others. I know how to search. That's all.
On
the internet along with everyone else.
Oh, indeed. You came up with some very, very interesting material. A big question for me would be, why would somebody like Snowden put himself through what's happened to him? He's under indictment, three or four charges under the Espionage Act. I mean, is that a ruse? I mean, are they fake charges? Is it put out publicly, but it really isn't so? I mean, why would you want to go through something like this? And he certainly has kicked over a can of worms that has exposed a lot of NSA stuff. My God, I've written about so much of it myself. I mean, this is stuff you would think any spy agency would not want made public. And yet, there it is, in chapter and verse, so much detail. I've probably written 24 or more articles on NSA spying. I've lost count how many. It could be 36. Goes back especially. I wrote about NSA spying before Snowden's revelations. I wrote about an article titled something to the effect of institutionalized U.S. spying, and I wrote that about 3, 4, 5 years ago, and maybe a few articles after that. And then when the scandal broke last June or so, I really began writing one article after another, and I've got more material to put out. So I have to wonder, what on earth would a guy like Snowden want to put himself through this, where he's, publicly, he's public enemy number one, almost, pretty close to it. He's living in Russia, where I'm certain he prefers not to live. I mean, to go to a strange country and learn a strange language that's not very easy to learn, instead of being home from Hawaii, no less, I mean, that is really a radical change. And he could be there for a while, and he simply can't come home. At least we think he can't come home, because he would end up in a courtroom indicted. I would imagine he would be. And is all this fake? I mean, if the guy came home and he wasn't tried and he didn't go to prison, I mean, then you really would smell a rat.
All great questions. You know, his murky background, his sudden rise from nothing through a series of stepping stones that are, clearly indicate, the deep state, as Peter Dale Scott has coined. This web of interests now gathering around him, who themselves have deep intel state apparatus interests. It starts to look like the limited hangout, that where you say yes, you get ahead of what might be a leak that you cannot otherwise control. So you get your guy to do the leak, and you figure out how far this is going to go and what interests are going to surround him and manage the process, none of whom have explicit connections to State Department or otherwise, but all of whom can be counted on to do the right thing. I don't know. I mean, this reminds me, in the case of roping Greenwald into this, this reminds me of when Dan Rather thought that he finally had George Bush Sr. by the short hairs in a scandal, and it turned out that it was a Karl Rove, a brilliant Karl Rove tactic to snare Dan Rather into looking very foolish for, bringing someone on to interview who disavowed all of the claims that Rather had believed were true from this individual, and Rather, is a disgrace for him. Rather had been gunning for George Bush a good part of his career, and this was a fall from grace he never recovered from. Anyway, this is what comes to my mind. I can't remember all the details of that, but it could be dredged up quickly. But this comes to my mind with Greenwald. Here is this globe-trotting, high-profile journalist with unimpeachable cachet, so far as we know, a constitutional lawyer himself, who's been writing and talking and embarrassing the heck out of the national security state for several years now. He's a very, very talented speaker, debater. He's a gifted guy. And now it appears on the surface that he's snared. That he's snared into this almost as if it's a kind of sting operation. I'm shocked reading this stuff, but, then again, at some point, it doesn't pay to be shocked anymore.
Man, I must agree with you that the deal he has with this PayPal guy, I've seen his name a few times, but I never remember it, and you mentioned it. The deal really has a very bad odor to it. I mean, why would a billionaire
want to
up an awful lot of money for a guy that's exposing state secrets? It just doesn't wash at all. So there's got to be something wrong with this thing somewhere. Is Greenwald being used as a convenient stooge? I mean, is he somebody that's actively involved in creating a fraud on the U.S. public? I mean, I honestly don't know. I've read his stuff.
Yeah, I think. I have a feeling that he's been snared. I mean, if the Omidyar just alone, just Omidyar and his web of connections alone is, I don't think that Greenwald is a guy, is a deep cover guy. I'd be really shocked. But he appears to have been snared. I mean, just on the surface of this, that Snowden reached out to him, right? Greenwald didn't reach out to Snowden. I don't think that's how this worked. Snowden reached out to him. Snowden marked him in the parlance of CIA ops, right? Snowden marked him.
You have to ask, why would he do it? Well, one reason was that Greenwald had a byline with the London Guardian. There were lots of good journalists around. certainly who could do the same kind of job, but they don't have the exposure that somebody with a major publication would have, and Greenwald certainly had that. We need to take a short break, Matt. Hold these thoughts, and we'll come back and we'll pick up on them as soon as we come back. Welcome back. I'm speaking with Matthew Witt. Matt, I would say this. I've got a lot of things I could say, but I'll start off with this comment. If a certain Edward Snowden happens to be one of my listeners, I mean, he can pick up the program anywhere on the planet, as far as I know. If you can get connected online, you can certainly listen to this program. You can listen to it live, or you can listen to it through the archives, which is the way most of my listeners do it. If he is listening now or listens later and he would like to make his own comments, then I certainly welcome him as a guest. And my email address is on the bottom of every article I write. There are a few of them around, I would say. And if he will contact me, I will schedule him and I'll get him on this program and he can have his say. He can have it as long as he wants. He can have the whole program to have his say. Well, of course, I'll have my say too.
That's very generous of you, Stephen.
Well, that would be quite a program if I had him on.
I would certainly add my comments. Doesn't have to copy me in that email. I just assume he not be in touch with me.
He's very familiar with NSA and what they do, and I'm not familiar with the inner workings other than to say there is no question I'm on their list, and the CIA's list, and the FBI's list, and all the other, I imagine, the other U.S. intelligence agencies' lists. But as I've said on this program a few times, I make it very easy for them, Matt, because everything I do is absolutely in the open. So they can know me as well as anybody who reads my articles or listens to this program knows me. And there's nothing secret about my private life. There's not a lot to it. I spend most of my time writing and doing media work.
on this story, if we could stick with this for a moment, Stephen. The dramaturgy here is striking. You know, you have this guy coming out of nowhere, Snowden. You have the press very predictably assuming their various roles around him. And so on the one hand, you have the left-wing press, what's left of it, the independents, somewhat independence, you know, valorizing the man without knowing his story, really, just valorizing the act and speculating and making their hay with it. And then you, of course, have the very predictable right-wing angry media denouncing him as a traitor, and so they get to make their hay, too. And all of us in the public get to tune in to our stations and be, you know, availed of what's going on in the world and reaffirmed that there is a press out there for us telling us what we need to know. And, you know, there's a lot that can be made with that. Then you have the NSA who, along with Obama, can act offended and trot out their talking heads to fluff up the denunciation and the indictment. It gives them a chance to tell their story the way they want to tell it without being gainsaid about everything that has happened since Patriot Act and 9/11. That now can be sort of pushed aside, and what we have here is a dangerous leak, a reckless do-gooder at best. This story gets hemmed in on all sides, and you know, appears to substantiate to the public that, that, you know, there are leaks, there are leakers, the United States government is not all-knowing and all-powerful, it is vulnerable. It can then tell its story under the conditions of this limited hangout vulnerability. Now, he's leaked a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff has come out that that is embarrassing and et cetera. My question is any of it really terribly relevant? And what end of the iceberg are we seeing here? So now with this revelation about Snowden's connections, and again, I'm just struck by this, the plausibility that this was an elaborate snare of a guy who otherwise was getting too big for his britches, Glenn Greenwald, as well as meeting a bunch of other objectives. It just starts to fit that pattern like the Gestalt image of the old woman and the young woman. It's both and. It's a paradox and a contradiction at the same time. But it starts to, the storyline start to fit another pattern.
Matt, I think the one thing that I could say for almost dead certain is, regardless of the information that's come out, regardless of what will come out ahead, I would certainly guess, absolutely nothing at NSA, FBI, CIA, and the rest of them has changed. Nothing has changed in Congress. Nothing has changed in the White House. Nothing has changed throughout all of the U.S. government agencies. So really, opening up the hornet's nest, if you want to call it that, U.S. policy remains exactly the way it was before, and so-called stuff going on in Congress where discussions and possible legislation of modifying NSA practices, I've written a little bit about that. The stuff that's being considered really will end up doing virtually nothing. You know, it's just a little bit of do-goodism, or but feel-goodism in language that can easily be twisted any way the spy agencies or anybody else wants to twist them, and business as usual can go on, nothing changing. And I've written about a bill, I think, sponsored by Dianne Feinstein in the Senate, just a terrible bill that basically gives the NSA a complete latitude to do what it wants, but again, couched in language that makes it seem as though it's not quite that way, as if they're reining them in a little bit, when in fact they're not reining them in at all. Again, the wiggle room, you know, the loopholes are so big that they can say anything they want, but they can twist the law very, very easily and simply go on doing exactly what they're doing, and nobody will challenge them. And the courts are virtually rubber stamped, with one exception. This Richard Leon, a week or so ago, in late December, coming down on the side of calling NSA spying, quote-unquote, unconstitutional. And that's exactly what it is. And he added, he said, what they're doing is almost Orwellian. Well, it isn't almost. I mean, it is Orwellian. But here's a federal judge coming down and saying that. But he's the exception, because there were many other federal judges at the district, at the appeals court levels, that have said exactly the opposite. And his decision is being appealed to a higher level. It's going to be overturned. And if it ever gets to the Supreme Court, which I think it will at some point, the Supreme Court will basically rubber stamp what NSA is doing. So what are we accomplishing?
We're accomplishing, you know, what is it, the Chinese handcuff? The more you try to wiggle out of it, the more you get snared in.
Oh, indeed.
I call it Morwellian. You know, it's actually, to me, it's on orders of magnitude. It follows the basic script of 1984, but its orders of magnitude are much greater than he could have imagined, because of what cyberspace makes permissible and how it snares us all.
Indeed.
How the grid snares us all. I think the Matrix film story narrative is a wonderful way of putting into a storytelling context what's really happening to us, a world that we believe to be real, vivid, and within our grasp, at least in our closest experience, is in fact a fabricated world, conceived by an evil genius to deceive us, you know, borrowing from Descartes. He wondered in his meditations, is this world that I think so vividly to be real actually so, or was it created by an evil genius to deceive me? I shall proceed from there to determine how so, and then he goes through his meditations to come up with his cogito argument, I think, therefore I am. But in a Orwellian world, thinking does not determine reality. It does not determine that you it may determine that you exist. The cogito may be pertinent that we exist, but that we exist does not mean that we are not massively controlled. Still, and the Matrix film story does really a wonderful job of laying out the plausibility of control on an awesome scale. But this in the case of where we're at with NSA and the binds that keep cinching in, it reminds me very much that you brought up the Orwell. I was thinking, wishing to talk with you, the sort of increasing feelings of dread as an academic that, you know, how difficult it is to speak openly with colleagues about these issues. It's just extremely difficult. No one, it's a slight exaggeration to say that no one wants to talk about it. Even the most otherwise informed, radical people I know, they do not want to talk. They do not want to go down this rabbit hole.
Do they feel they're being watched? And if they do speak about it, it'll harm them.
This is a really, really important question, Stephen. For me, what's vivid is if you had a chance seeing the 1984 film production of 1984 with John Hurt in the role of Winston and Richard Burton playing, was it O'Brien? But Winston is the protagonist of the story. And if I recall, the story opens with Winston sitting to the side of this big telescreen in his home, you know, the all-watching panopticon eye, watching everyone in their home, a two-way television, cameras everywhere, not unlike our world now. But he's sitting to the side, out of angle view of the camera, and he's writing notes to himself, an offense that would be punishable by torture. And he's writing these notes, not unlike Descartes, you know, trying to formulate his meditations about whether he exists and who he is and what's really important. And if I recall, he's contemplating this woman at some point that he's wondering if she's for real. He can trust her to disclose his feelings to her, his thoughts about everything. And he's a guy, Winston, in the story of 1984, he's a guy that works intel himself. He works for the Ministry of Information, and his job is to reconstruct history. His job is to make certain stories go away and fabricate others. And so he's a guy in the know. I mean, he's a guy in the know. He's a intel worker himself. But the torture of his isolation didn't require him to be in solitary confinement, literally. And yet he was in solitary confinement. And that was a feeling I flashed on recently as I thought about, you know, except for a few very trusted people, and myself, I'm relatively very uninformed in these matters compared to you and so many people I know. I'm really a neophyte. But, you know, even what I know, trying to say it with people otherwise who would consider themselves pretty radical is extremely difficult. And it never gets above a hushed tone. wherever it is, as if someone's listening. So to answer your question directly, it's always an as if someone may be listening, except I think that it's deeper than that. I think really who's listening is all of us, our own conscience, that is, you know, sort of saying, wake up, you know, wake up. And none of us are ever entirely sure to what extent we want to wake up. I mean, you know, you don't want to walk around in a constant state of dread. And yet, for us to salvage this world that's in increasing peril, in profound ways, right? Orwell did not glimpse ecological collapse. Aldous Huxley didn't glimpse ecological collapse. Charles and Mary Beer didn't glimpse ecological collapse. How could they? But we can very clearly see it. And this situation is matrixed into everything that NSA is about. They're entirely about an imperial world divested of freedoms, a slave ship on Earth. This is entirely what they're devoted to. And most people would say, yeah, that's true. But people don't want to hear too much about what all they've done. They don't want to talk about the grotesque fraud and scientific impossibility of the official accounts of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, of the official accounts of the 9/11 incident. People don't want to talk about that. And in each instance, John F. Kennedy and 9/11 in particular, was the reformulation of the state. The state reformed itself. It became something different. You know, we all blinked, as it were, with the Warren Commission. Not all of us. Many people refused to accept, and there was enormous skepticism in the public at large for that incident, as there was eventually with the 9/11 incident. But essentially what happened was the state and its increasingly arbitrary authority to declare reality was affirmed. Before John F. Kennedy, science wasn't put on trial. But on that day, and with the Warren Commission report, science itself was put on trial with the magic bullet premise. Then, with the magic bullet and the bullet trajectories and the wound trajectories of Kennedy making it absolutely impossible that there was a single shooter in this universe, absolutely impossible. Then with the 9/11 incident, again, science itself was put on trial. September 10th, the laws of thermodynamics worked a certain way. September 12th, they worked a certain way. But September 11th, they worked another way. And that the state can get away with putting science itself on trial, that has to sink in. You know, that order of magnitude of fraud, that has to sink in. That's a huge intellectual crisis. That's huge. That's the crisis that Galileo presented when he insisted, until he saw the torture instruments, that the Earth orbited the Sun. That was a crisis too. So, I mean, I really think this is a level of this is a level of intellectual crisis, of ontological crisis, of existential crisis that we're going through. And it's venues like your own, you know, valiantly trying to make open these channels, which I really appreciate myself in the small role that I'm trying to play.
Well, there are others. But, there are others doing the same thing, Matt. And of course, this didn't exist a number of years ago. When I got out of school, a freshly minted MBA in 1960, I spent a number of years as a marketing analyst. I never really remember a political discussion about anything throughout those years, about 6-7 years, before I got involved in a small family business. And, you know, there we could talk about anything we wanted. And, But we really devoted ourselves to business. We didn't spend a lot of time during the daytime talking about politics or other stuff. You know, maybe a little idle chit-chat here and there. But business was business, and that's what we devoted ourselves to. But back as a marketing analyst in big corporations, the names would be familiar to most listeners. At least one of them no longer exists. Got merged with another company that was merged to a larger one, and so on, as it happens over the years. But I never remember that, and the only day that was so startling that it was impossible to forget for me was November 1963, and of course the Kennedy assassination. When it, I think it happened on a Friday, and I learned about it at lunch break, and everything came to a halt, as you can imagine. And if there was discussion, it was that day before we just kind of went home in a fog, wondering what the heck was going on. And then Oswald killed by Jack Ruby and so on. And I certainly began to smell a rat. I didn't know anything about magic bullets or anything like that. But I never remember any discussion. If it was a Friday, coming back on Monday, I don't remember discussions about it in the office after that. Maybe a few comments here and there, but I don't remember anything that stood out in my mind. So it was all business. And, of course, back in those days, Matt, there was no kind of mass surveillance. There was nothing even remotely close to what was going on now. And I have no idea what our bosses might have felt if we began talking politics on the job. I had a couple of very decent bosses. They might have felt exactly the same way that I did. Although I must say that my beliefs and the way I expressed them certainly developed over the years, and they were a shadow back in those days compared to what they are now.
You know, in the parlance, developed with remarkable prescience by Naomi Klein, the shock doctrine.
Mm.
That she's not. She's the journalist identifying it. It originated in mid-century with speculations on the effects of shock therapy on psychiatric patients, and the question whether or not the mind could be literally reset through that therapy. But the shock doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism, is what she wrote, published in 2007, and became pretty instantly a bestseller, now translated into scores of languages across the globe.
You know, I didn't know that.
The Kennedy incident was a shock. Yeah.
I read the book, Matt, and I wrote about it. And indeed, there was an awful lot of good material in there. The shock doctor and the economic shock doctor, who she mentioned, was Milton Friedman.
Yes. Yes. Precisely. And, you know, whether we're jolted by a trauma like the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, the Allende, the coup in Chile, and of all things, September 11th, 1973.
Indeed.
And the series of shocks that rippled through Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, and other Southern Cone play. Well, that is the Southern Cone, but then there was Brazil, and then Central America in the 80s with Reagan. But this followed from right immediately after the war. Arbenz was ousted in 54 in Guatemala. We've been on this, as you point out, this rampage of muffled warfare ever since World War II. It's been nonstop.
Indeed. Reagan in America, Margaret Thatcher in Britain. Yeah, that was in her book. And, of course, Katrina in New Orleans and the
yes.
Iraq situation. There was so much in that book. It got a lot of publicity, which, of course, helped her a great deal. But there's a lot of good material in it.
Before we close, I wanted to give, again, credit. Kevin Ryan's blog, Dig Within, he's a very diligent chronicler. Kevin Ryan goes back to Underwriter Laboratories. He was a whistleblower for Underwriter Labs' willingness to go along with the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, NIST.
Yeah,
he blew the whistle on Underwriter Labs rubber stamping the NIST report on 9/11 matters and lost his job and went on to become a writer, blogger, and he's I believe Kevin's a mechanical engineer by training. And then the Boiling Frog, Seidel Edmonds, for the Snowden material, also Kevin for the Snowden material. But yeah, and yourself, there are many, many people. How much longer we'll have these channels open, who can know?
It's what one of the many things that, that concerns me, Matt. I mean, you just never know. If they want to bring the hammer down on us, they certainly can do it very easily. As far as 9/11 goes, I certainly take my hat off to David Ray Griffin, who has written 10 books on 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, one would have been a great achievement. And David,
yeah,
late in his life, a professor of religion of all backgrounds,
yes,
10 books,
yes,
on 9/11, terrific books.
Remarkable.
Matt, we're out of time. The music tells me to get off. Many thanks. I look forward to having you back again. Oh, we covered some important ground today. To my listeners, tune in tomorrow. Hopefully the weather will let us. We'll be on same time. And on Fridays, we're always on at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.